This is the Happy Warrior Podcast, 1 week to go to the presidential election. And so, in this, our final October surprise episode, we will first be discussing how big tech has teamed up with mainstream media journalism in an attempt to swing this election to the Democrats and Joe Biden, but more importantly, to wrest away the levers of control on our Republican democracy from the American public and instead give it to our corporations, the woke, and the elite. And to be discussing this issue with us, we will have an interview with Breitbart tech reporter Alan Bukhari. He's an investigative reporter that's broke open more big tech censorship stories than just about anyone else. So we are so excited to discuss this topic and share that with you. We will then go into our final diagnosis of the presidential election and who we think has a real shot at winning next Tuesday. And it may surprise you what we have to say. Much has changed in just the last week. And of course, how could we forget ACB, baby? So please get comfortable, pull up your favorite chair, put on your seatbelt, and let's have ourselves a podcast.
The Happy Warrior Podcast. Conservative commentary on the news of the day from a more positive perspective.
Ha ha! All right, guys, we did it! Amy Coney Barrett was just voted in and confirmed to the United States Supreme Court in a 52-48 vote.
I, Amy Coney Barrett, do solemnly swear
that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I take this obligation freely.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation.
Without any mental reservation.
Or purpose of evasion.
Or purpose of evasion.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge.
The duties of the office from which I am about to enter.
The duties of the office from which I am about
to enter. So help me God.
So help me God.
Well, there you have it, everyone. ACB, Amy Coney Barrett, is now confirmed to the United States Supreme Court, giving a technical conservative majority of 6-3. It's more like 5-4 because of Roberts. But still, this is a monumental shift in the balance of the Supreme Court. And this means big things for people who are interested in freedom and to the judiciary sticking to the Constitution. And for me, for whatever happens next week, I have to say that the Republicans getting ACB on the Supreme Court, the Trump administration filling all these seats in the federal judiciary is a humongous win, and it will have positive ramifications for freedom for generations to come. This is an incredible achievement the Trump administration and the Senate Republicans have pulled off. It was not an easy thing to pull off. You have less than a month to make this happen in such a hotly contested adversarial environment, and they were able to get people to come out and support him. Mitt Romney for one, Senator Lisa Murkowski for another. I mean, these were people who are not friendly to Trump and the Republicans by putting up such a strong, powerful, just professional, top-level candidate, an amazing jurist in ACB, Amy Coney Barrett. They just couldn't say no to it. So Republicans, they did it. They did it. Now, this is a bit of a first because there were zero Democrats that supported this move. And we'll have to see what that means for the future of the Supreme Court, because, of course, we know there are people pushing for court packing and judicial reform. But let me tell you, friends, if you need a positive to come out of 2020, if you are interested in the freedom and the future stability of the republic, this is a good moment. This is a good night. This is something that should be celebrated, and we are going to start out this episode not down the depths, and there are serious issues that should concern you guys. big tech, our first segment here, it's just so disconcerting what's happening there. But there are good things that happen, and they deserve to be pointed out when they do. And this is one of those moments. And I've been a harsh critic of President Trump. I've been a harsh critic of the GOP lately. But I mean, well done. Well done, Mr. President. Well done, Republicans. This is a good night. Whatever the Dems do, they were likely already going to do it anyways. So you might as well fulfill your constitutional role and put an originalist jurist on the Supreme Court, and you did it. And she's amazing. And I can't help but smile. It puts a big smile on my face, and I am in need of smiles. And I think, my dear listener, you are too. On that happy note, we have to move to something very serious. This is the main segment of our episode today. And that is the incestuous, unholy relationship, this feedback machine that's been created between big tech and journalism. Big Misses is in there too, and politicians. And it's this very destructive, negative feedback loop that is the biggest issue facing our country, probably our generation will face. I mean, maybe China is a bigger threat, but internally, the force that we have to face is this. And I come at it, of course, as an American. I come at it as a journalist. And to watch how my profession in the mainstream, the people we're supposed to look up to, have sold their souls is heartbreaking. And they've been corrupted to such a degree that I never thought it was going to get this bad. This is much worse than what happened during the summer when they sold out the objectivity ethic. They've come to a new place of a new low. And we know it primarily due to the Hunter Biden story. This is our canary in the coal mine, and the canary died. As you know, the story, as we talked about last week, the New York Post reported on a laptop the FBI had gotten and had verified that Hunter Biden had signed it, having emails and materials showing strong evidence that Hunter Biden had been trading on the name and the influence of his famous dad, Vice President Joe Biden, to China, the Ukraine, and elsewhere, and by doing so, sold out national secrets, made it possible for companies that held strategic value to be bought up by China. Essentially, they sold the country out in favor of some good cash for the family. And there is evidence in there, and it's referred to by some of the business partners that worked with Joe Biden, who came up publicly and was at the debate, Abel Binsky, that Joe Biden was aware. At the very least, he was aware. We have strong, strong evidence to suggest he knew this was happening. But worse, that he encouraged it and was part of it. That part, we cannot totally confirm. This is a humongous story. Now, it used to be, even a year ago, that this story comes out and the media would cover it. They may cover it and go through the details and just say, all this is false, but they would still share the details with you. Okay, it'd be a Republican's pounce kind of story. The country doesn't even get that much. No, they have decided, mainstream journalists have decided, that this election is so important. They don't want Republicans and Trump to stay in the White House. They so hate Orange Man bad, they have decided that they will not report on the existence of the Hunter Biden story in any way whatsoever. And if anyone approaches them about it, they will ignore its existence. They will deny it happened. And they will do whatever they can so it is not discussed. Worse yet, these same journalists are now advocating and going to big tech and asking them to censor people for talking about this story. Journalism is going to big companies, and they are advocating that people have their rights to free speech removed. They are asking people to not be allowed inside the public square. The key trick in all this is to not do the homework and to not report even one bit. And then they will come to you and say, this story is illegitimate because no one's reported on it.
It's this. I think it's one of the biggest scandals I've ever seen, and you don't cover it.
Biggest.
You want to talk about...
Well, because it can't be verified.
You want to talk about insignificant things.
I'm telling you.
Of course it can be verified. Excuse me. They found the laptop. Leslie.
Can't be verified.
10 held for H, Hunter, for the big guy, which we now have confirmed. The big guy, according to Hunter Biden's former business associate, is Joe Biden. We're talking tens of millions of dollars with the associates of the Chinese Communist Party.
You actually sound like you're on a Fox News show right now. You sound a little bit like an anchor.
Well,
from
unfortunately,
there.
Fox is one of the only news channels that's covering these real emails.
Even Fox News would not touch this story that President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, tried to dump. You know that. Even the New York Post, the key reporter, did not want
his byline on this story. Fox News just confirmed Hunter Biden's former business associate, who identified by name, Joe Biden is the big guy.
He's running for president of the United States, and this is serious. This is not last year's news. It's whether or not his son was coordinating to get him to talk to these Ukraine oligarchs. And he was benefiting from it. I mean, it's just, it's really dirty.
Okay,
and
Brian, it needs to be looked at. Forgive me, Brian Stelter, and then I want to move on to the Google, which is a related story. Brian.
I said it was last season. You're saying it's new. I think bottom line is we don't know what is real and what is fake in these emails, if there is anything real in them.
Yeah, but that didn't stop any from reporting the Mueller and the dossier and all that stuff.
You're bitter. Now, I understand that you have a lot of resentment about it.
Now we have ethics. Okay, now we have ethics.
Don't you dare act like newsrooms didn't have ethics in 2017 and 2018.
Well, I know they did. Well, you can don't dare me all you want, Brian. I've been doing this for 30 years. So say whatever you want. It's my view. And I have a right to say it.
So there you have it, folks. Three examples of people trying to talk to mainstream journalists. Hey, there is this issue. Why aren't you talking about it? And the reactions are, this doesn't exist. La, 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 la. It can't be verified because it hasn't been verified. It can't be verified because it hasn't been verified. And Stelter, he does his little inner Greta Thunberg. How dare you? And of course, we end there with Christiane Amanpour, the respected international reporter, who says, well, this is all made up. Even Fox News says it's made up, which, of course, as she points out, is not true. Those are three video examples, and there are countless more, of people trying to go to mainstream journalists and say, why aren't you talking about this story? Why won't you even talk about how everyone on the right that's been locked out of this for talking about? Or people who are just, you know, the oldest newspaper in the country still going, New York Post, how it's been over 2 weeks now, and it is still suspended from its Twitter account. And they are told, you will not be given your Twitter account back until you delete the 6 tweets that contain the stories that we had a problem with. Now, my concern is that we are allowing journalism ethics and our freedom to be sold because this is a political issue that affects the Dems. That is my concern in this story. The story itself is hugely important. Is Joe Biden, as Peter Schweitzer, the investigative reporter who's written a book on this, the most corrupt vice president in American history or not? And if he was, what does that mean when he is president? This is a serious and big story. Okay, this is newsworthy by any definition, by anyone, from any side of the spectrum. But the left, because they are so fearful of Donald Trump still remaining president, has decided that this story is not only something they must ignore and not verify, but that anyone who does share it should be censored. And they have gone to big tech, and they have encouraged them to do this. And as Alan Bukhari, of the guy I'm going to share this his interview I did with him this week in a little bit, has shown, journalists have largely been the one in the last 4 years that have cheered on for censorship more than anyone else. Here is Senator Tom Cotton on CNBC, and he asked the question all of us are asking, why won't you cover the story? Listen keenly to the second part of the reporter's answer. What he says big tech should be doing.
The media is not doing the country any favors by essentially ignoring this story.
Senator, I wanted to make 2 points. One is that the media industry, at least the media industry that I know, has been trying to investigate this and has not been able to corroborate the story. I would also note the Wall Street Journal, which is owned by News Corporation, which also owns the New York Post, has not been able to corroborate the story and said so quite directly in the Wall Street Journal today, in the news pages of the Wall Street Journal. So just to clarify, it is not that the news organizations are not looking into this is that they haven't been able to corroborate the story, and a responsible news organization wouldn't therefore report it. Now, the next piece of this is you're talking about the tech companies censoring such quote-unquote news. If, in fact, the tech companies had quote-unquote liability, like news operations do, you wouldn't want them to be reporting something that they couldn't corroborate, no?
Do you mean like the Russian collusion hoax and the Steele dossier that you reported on for 4 years, Andrew?
Amazing. I mean, that was a good response by Cotton, but could you hear what he was saying? He said, well, the story isn't real, and of course we don't want the social media companies letting people talk about it. But we know that the social media companies have let people talk about not real stuff all this 4 years. With the support of politicians and big tech and companies, they have thrived. The journalism industry has soaked up bags of money talking about what we might call fake news. Now, do I think fake news is great? No, but we have a First Amendment, and we encourage a public square. People should be able to talk about these stories. If something is untrue, the way you combat it is by showing the truth. But something has changed, my good friends. Something has changed in the hearts and minds of those who are on the left, not the normies, but the people with power, especially in journalism and tech, that they have given up the ghost on the fight, on the big game, on the debate, the national conversation, okay? We have a national conversation. We disagree on things. Who has control of the prevailing narrative? Yeah, that changes, but we discuss it, we debate it, we move forward, and that's how this country works. And what has happened essentially is parts of the left, particularly in media and in tech, are weary of the debate. They are done with it. They are sick of the back and forth. They want control on the reins of power, and they want it to be final and done. What happened was that tech and journalism had understand that there is a back and forth in democracy. There is a national conversation. There is a debate. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. And they realized that what happens when the Republicans win, when the Trump win, it's so bad. And it's putting them so far away from their goals, often about social justice, that, you know what? Democracy is too hard. And so before they had understood that the conversation, the national discussion, the debate is how we decide things. We win by persuading majorities. And they saw they had the power, and they said, take it. Take that power. Use it. Use it to win. We want to win. We're sick of this all. We finally want to make our goals happen. And so it changed. Right now, it's no longer a question of winning the debate. It's no longer of having the truth on your side. What is happening to us? And it was being led and encouraged by journalists. And this has happened slowly but surely over the last 4 years. It has moved away from about winning the debate, and it has become a no-holds-barred thing about power. Or to put it as Jack Sparrow would, our politics moved from debate into...
Put it away, son. It's not worth you getting beat again.
You didn't beat me. You ignored the rules of engagement, and a fair fight could kill you.
That's not much incentive for me to fight fair, then, is it? Now, as long as you're just hanging there, pay attention. The only rules that really matter are these. What a man can do and what a man can't do.
That is what's happened now. And so when it's about what a man can't do and what a man can't, it opens up a long line of actions you can take. So, for example, Facebook and YouTube are now censoring and banning Trump-sympathetic accounts left and right. Most of the time, they say they are Q-affiliated, even though many of those channels have stated publicly on Twitter that they have nothing to do with the Q folks and, in fact, are against it. YouTube is running fact checks at the top of search results for just about anything Joe Biden, including not just Ukrainian stuff, but from the debate when Biden said that he would like to transition out of fossil fuels, out of oil. That's true. That was Biden's stance. Biden is against fracking, essentially. Well, YouTube is putting there right at the top that this is untrue. This is false. In spite of the knowledge that we know that Biden's campaign, and particularly Kamala Harris, have said out loud they will try to ban fracking. And of course, there's plenty of interference happening by Twitter. Conservative accounts are losing followers. just by the gallon. If you're a conservative creator on Kickstarter or GoFundMe, you are being kicked off. And in all in front of this, when people are trying to tell people in the media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, what is their response to this censorship? Do the concerns of people who might be conservative point this out? Basically, it's to say this problem either doesn't exist or this is a good thing. And so that is where we are at, my friends. Journalists in the mainstream media have given up on the debate, on the national conversation. They want big tech to get involved and to hurt all their political enemies and to push them off social media, make it so they can't do business, and to allow the social justice and the woke of the left rise finally to prominent position so they can usher in the right kind of politics and perhaps one day their utopia. Hey guys, Pete here. If you like what you hear today, please leave us a 5-star review in iTunes and be sure to tell your family and friends about this podcast, word of mouth, and of course on our social media, which you can find us at Happy Warrior Pete on Twitter and Parler and at Happy Warrior Pete on Facebook and Minds. We appreciate the support you give the podcast and my work. And if you'd like, you can leave a message through Anchor, which you can check out at the bottom of the podcast description. Thank you for your time. Please listen and enjoy. Welcome back. Well, now after that segment, to give you an idea of what is going on right now between journalism and big tech, now that you have that background, I want to share with you my big interview with investigative tech reporter Alan Bukhari. Alan is the tech reporter over at Breitbart News. He is one of the founding members of Breitbart Tech. He has broken open almost more big tech censorship stories in the last 5 years than just about any other journalist living. I am a big fan. He is one of my tech reporting heroes. Alan recently published his big book that takes all of his reporting and goes big picture about what's happening with big tech and censorship. The book is called #Deleted, Big Tech's Battle to Erase the Trump Movement and Steal the Election. It's a great book. I had the privilege of interviewing Alan over the weekend. Unfortunately, we had just crazy amount of tech issues due to crazy technical issues that took place during the interview. We lost part of the audio, but we have most of it here. I literally spent 12 hours over the weekend just cleaning audio up. But I think you can make out what he's saying. It's a good interview. The book is so important because the issue of big tech censorship, our media and big tech trying to take control of our democracy, take control of our decisions, it's so important. And so Alan Bukhari, he reports on this stuff. He's so on point. I love his work. So it's a privilege to have him here on the Happy Warrior podcast. That is better. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Do we want to, can we restart? So Alan, let's tell the folks a little bit about yourself. What's your background? You're a tech reporter, you're investigative tech reporter with Breitbart. How did you get into that? What's your scoop?
So I started working for Breitbart in 2015 when Breitbart first launched Breitbart Tech, this new product to cover technology. And I think we were really ahead of the curve because back in 2015, no other conservative media outlet, as far as I know, had a dedicated tech reporting team. And we saw the threat of free speech coming from the social justice warriors on campus, and we saw them coming for the internet as well. And we really, this was, by the way, before Trump even won the GOP nomination. But we really saw this all escalate after the Trump election. You mentioned that Google case where we saw, the executives of Google, the co-founders, the CEO, everyone else up on stage lamenting the Trump victory and talking about what needs to be done. We saw one executive, say he wanted to make the populist movement a blip in history. And these are the leaders of the most powerful technology company in the world. If you want to watch that video, by the way, it's a 1-hour recording with me. It was published at Breitbart News. You can find it there. And that's why I wrote this book, I think. You know,
deleted big text battle to erase the Trump movement and steal the election. And that sounds like a hyperbolic title, but it's not actually not really my opinion that big tech wants to steal the election. That's the opinion of the people I spoke to inside Facebook and Google and Twitter, who said this is basically what they're trying to do. They all went into meltdown after Trump won, and they all felt very, very guilty about not doing enough to stop him in 2016. So I do think the imperative of Silicon Valley over the past 4 years has been to make sure something like 2016 never happens again. It's sort of a, actually, it's a mix of Silicon Valley and outside forces like NGOs and journalists and obviously Democrat politicians who are sort of applying pressure on these companies to make, to censor their own platforms. So it's a combination of forces, but certainly social media today is very different to social media in 2016, and the same with Google and search engines and other major tech companies. They're much more controlled, and they're all focused on helping Biden win, as we saw over the past 2 weeks in the New York Post.
Incredible. You mentioned, you do point out that one of the things that came with this decision that they want to make sure they know what you're doing offline was they would take someone down if they interviewed someone that social media didn't like. And of course, who was the bad guy that they don't like all depends on that day and what they think. So it could be a Gavin McGinnis or it could be just, you know, Jordan Peterson, whatever. And it's what's amazing to me about this so much in this moment that we're in, and maybe you'd like to talk about this, is journalism's role in not doing their job, being okay with this, and in some cases, cheering it on.
Well, yeah, in many cases, cheering it on, actually. I think journalists have really pushed for even more Silicon Valley censorship. By journalists, you're obviously referring to the mainstream media, corporate media, but it's been a real priority for them because I think they recognized, as did much of elite society in 2016, that the internet and the independent media and the new media was a real threat to their power. I remember back in 2016, 2017, there were YouTubers who were getting higher audiences than cable hosts. Still the case now for some YouTubers, but obviously they've sort of shut that off, made it much harder for people to gain a following, especially if you're talking about politics, especially if you're talking about the news. And of course, they're also artificially prioritizing outlets like CNN, like BuzzFeed, like the New York Times now as well. So not only are they artificially turning down the volume on the independent media, they're turning up the volume on the mainstream media. And this is exactly what the mainstream media wanted because, you know, we were in a situation, they suddenly found themselves in a situation where a hidden their basement could, you know, suddenly accumulated audience bigger than a newsroom with a $10 billion budget. So the internet was really an existential threat. And as you said, they've just demanded more and more censorship. They've demanded that these unaccountable elites in Silicon Valley take more power for themselves. It's really shocking to see. And Silicon Valley really just, they're so terrified of journalists, I think probably justifiably, because journalists started the massive ad boycott against YouTube in, I think, either 2017 or 2018. And that took them hundreds of billions of dollars. They started an ad boycott against Facebook. So Silicon Valley is quite wary of journalists. So there's even been examples that I've covered where journalists will reach out to these companies. This is their sort of formula for deplatforming people. They'll reach out to their companies saying, this bad person is on your platform. Are you going to enforce your terms of service? Do you think this is acceptable? And they'll keep doing that. And they'll run hit pieces against the Silicon Valley company until they ban who they want them to ban. And it goes even beyond that. So with the search blacklist released from YouTube, that was another leak that Breitbart News. We saw that a journalist reached out to Google, said, "Look at the top 10 search results on YouTube for abortion. It's all pro-life videos. Too many pro-life videos." And within hours, Google had gone in and changed those YouTube search results so they prioritized the mainstream media. So one journalist can change search results on YouTube. Yeah.
I know it is disturbing. I feel like even since I went to J school, the people are up and coming. There is this feeling like here's how you do it. You find this, like you go to Reddit and you find that sub with all the terrible people, and then you contact Reddit and you complain about it, and then that's your story. And to me, it's like, wait a second, you missed a step here. That's not our job. Our job is not to get the king to come down and use his authority. Our job is to point out the truth and where things go wrong. It makes me depressed.
That's not what the journalists are supposed to be. It's supposed to be holding power to account, holding the powerful to account. Instead, journalists are demanding that these platforms take even more power for themselves, that they can wield over ordinary users. It's a complete inversion. And the other thing they do is, apart from going after the powerful, you mentioned Redditors, they go after ordinary Redditors. How many anonymous Reddit accounts have been doxxed by mainstream journalists? My friend Darren Beatty recently started exposing this one journalist at NBC who wrote a whole guide on exposing and doxing anonymous people on the internet. So that's insane to me. I mean, who are these anonymous people? They're probably just ordinary people. There's actually two chapters in the book, one of which is about how easy it's become to defame people. I call it the defamation page. It's the combination of journalists, Wikipedia, and Google. So before the internet, people who were affected by scandals, mainly celebrities and politicians, world leaders, not ordinary people. And what's more, even for the prominent people, it wouldn't stay in the news forever. It'd stay in the news maybe 2 days, maybe a week, it wouldn't. But now, not only do ordinary people have the risk of having their reputation destroyed if a journalist decides to write about you, but it'll also go on Wikipedia, because Wikipedia considers mainstream and left-wing journalists to be authoritative sources. And if it goes on Wikipedia, it'll go on the front page of Google, because Google prioritizes Wikipedia. And what's more, the people who might defend you, the people who might debunk the mainstream media, they aren't considered authoritative sources, so you much less likely to find them on the top page of Google. They'll never find them on Wikipedia either. So journalists, Wikipedia, and Google, that's what I call the defamation engine. There's this whole industry now of journalists who just, whether people are prominent or not, they'll find excuses to go after them and write about them and slander them as racist, alt-right, Nazis, and whatever else you can think of. So everyone's reputation is now sort of at risk. Actually, using Yelp, this reviewing company, you can review businesses and restaurants, they're now going to put a big red warning sign on businesses that have been accused of racism. So it's really like a new sort of scarlet letter, you know, the front page of Google, your profile on Yelp, and someone just accuses you of being a racist and conforming to the values of the ruling elite. Your reputation will be destroyed forever. It'll stay in your search results forever. So, this is another kind of decentralized totalitarianism.
I want to definitely talk about, because we know how the media, and we have a pretty good idea of how the left, for the most part, handles this. But I want to get into the conservatives. But what we do, that seems to be a common theme with big tech, is they can just, and you point to so many stories, like the right-wing news guys. I don't know if anyone hardly remembers them, but they were really big in 2016 to 2018, and then just overnight, that was it, and they were gone. And it seems like big tech has gone to this point, and journalists never called out, where they're, if they just decide today, you know what, you're a bad person, you're done. Yep. It doesn't matter how much you invest in it.
The thing goes beyond politics, because, you know, people's livelihoods depend on these platforms. There are people who build their entire business off of a Facebook page or a YouTube account, and they can take it away from you, and you have no due process, none at all. I mean, if a landlord threw you out of a physical business located at a physical store, you could take them to court if you thought their reasons were frivolous. But you can't do that with the tech giants, even though you might have a business, you know, $1 million business on Facebook or YouTube, have 100 employees. They can just take it away from you by banning you or changing their algorithm. And there's no recourse, there's no due process. This even happens to non-political sites. An example in the book I mentioned, Little Things, this website was basically about, you know, posting cat pictures. It was very successful. Facebook changes their algorithm in 2018, and that website suddenly goes out of business. So this is really an impossible situation, I think, for not just conservatives are the main target, of course, but any business, whether you're political or not, to be at the mercy of these tech giants. It's just a crazy, crazy situation.
It really is. So, you pretty much have me convinced, at least in the sense that something needs to be done. I'm not so sure exactly what, but it seems to be more than a lot of where, and this is the part that bugs me. Maybe it's because it's on my side, but as you rightly point out, Republicans, especially conservatives, are really, really bad on this issue. In my home state, my senator is John Thune, which you write about on there. And what is he? Senate Majority Whip. So he's like number two or three guy. And I mean, he is just the epitome of the Republican problem. So what is going on? Why do please tell our audience, why is it that Republicans, especially, but, you know, conservatives, libertarians in general, are they're so unwilling to deal with the issue of big tech or confront it?
It's like a few years behind everyone else. And he understands the issue. He's even got a bill that would create more transparency for the tech giants. But we're so beyond just demanding transparency from these people. I mean, we need to go far beyond that. In fairness to the Republicans, I mean, it's not just a Republican problem, it's a Senate problem in general. The whole all of Congress is just completely bought and paid for by these tech giants. And Thune may actually be one of the better ones. Probably not the best. I mean, Hawley and Cruz, people like that, they're sort of the leading voices on this issue. But so many Republicans either ignore the issue or they even defend big tech. We had sense of the New York Post, we had sense of the White House press secretary just over a week ago, and the Senate Judiciary Committee actually had trouble persuading all the Republicans to subpoena Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg. Mm-hmm. They were wavering early in the week. It took some persuasion. I mean, what will it take? What sort of how brazen do these tech giants have to be? How much election interference do they have to engage in before some of these Republicans start taking the issue seriously? It is amazing how there's only one arm of the government right now that's actually taking meaningful action on the tech giant problem, and that's the Trump administration. It's the Trump administration that passed an executive order on the issue. That executive order has allowed the FCC to take action. Ajit Pai came out and made a statement right after the New York Post censorship saying he supports altering some of big tech's legal privileges to make censorship harder. It's the Trump administration that appointed Adam Kandeyev to the federal bureaucracy. He's a free speech lawyer. He's actually sued Twitter on free speech cases in the past. Nominated Nathan Symington to the FCC, replacing the old Republican. It was merciless. There was one Republican FCC commissioner who was wavering on the issue of social media censorship. And instantly, Trump administration declines to renew his renomination and nominates this other guy, Nathan Symington, who's a forefront social media company. So they're taking the issue very seriously. They're putting the right people in the right positions. They're taking meaningful action. But it's amazing how it's just the Trump administration. If Biden were to do the opposite, he'll use the federal bureaucracy to pressure these companies to even more censorship. Congress, the Senate, often paid for, you won't see any action from them. Other governments, other Western governments, you know, they all have hate speech laws, so they're pressuring the tech companies to do even more censorship. The Trump administration, I think it's going to sound very partisan, it's the last hope for internet freedom. It really is. I can kind of understand all these people who say, well, the American Republic will inevitably descend into Caesarism just like the Roman Republic, because it does seem right now that the executive branch is the only branch of the government that's really representing the interests of the people and not the interests of big business and big tech. Certainly doesn't seem to be the case with Congress or the Senate.
I think it's insane. Just from a sheer power politics situation, I mean, the Republican... How much evidence do we need to show you guys that big tech is not... They're not on your side, guys. I mean... Yeah, remember when Jack Dorsey, at the drop of a hat, decided just willy-nilly to donate $10 million to Ibram X. Kendi? Okay, that just doesn't happen for the Republicans, and it's so ridiculous. I mean, you point out the story of K. James Cole at the Heritage Foundation. Even after that had happened, the Heritage Foundation official stance was no reform whatsoever on 230. The government just trying will mess it up, and I was just, ugh.
The Heritage is a nightmare on this issue. Almost every conservative think tank has been influenced by big tech. Big tech, by the way, the biggest lobbyist spending, the biggest lobbyist spenders in Washington, D.C. right now. They're the new oil companies, they're the new banks. They are the top dogs in Washington, D.C. They're the ones who spend the most money. And they fund conservative think tanks. They fund progressive think tanks. They control everything.
Yikes. Okay, so what is, now you don't have, because the journalist's job is not to provide solutions, even though that's what journalists like doing these days, but what is your view of a legitimate path forward for dealing with the issue of big tech? I know the Democrats are pushing hard for this, but like you point out, they are likely going to push for antitrust and stuff, but they aren't going to say, hey, wait a minute, stop censoring people. They're actually going to be saying, no, you don't understand. We want you to censor more.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know what would be a legitimate path forward you might advise our politicians, particularly, I guess, the GOP, on the path to take.
Yeah, a lot of people are excited about antitrust, but, you know, in the wrong hands, antitrust can actually be a weapon for more censorship, not less censorship. With the Democrats, the Democrat administration and their Justice Department doing antitrust about people, you can bet that behind the scenes they'll be saying to the tech giants, well, yeah, if you censor this person or that news publication, we'll be nicer to you in the settlement negotiations. I can totally see the Democrat administration doing that. Hopefully the Republicans are not stupid enough to simply that the antitrust investigators do that thing, but actually, talk to the tech companies and say, look, you've got to take political bias seriously. But this is another feature of the Democrats. They're always, antitrust essentially is, corporations versus corporations. Google's competitors trying to get themselves in a better situation. So companies like Yelp, which serves and talked about just as bad as Google, very left-wing, will benefit from antitrust action against Google. Bing and Yahoo will benefit from antitrust action against Google. But these are all far-left companies themselves, so is that really an improvement that really fix the problem of censorship or political bias? No, not inherently. What would fix the problem, I think, is the right kind of changes to Section 230, which is this law that tech companies rely on to censor as well. What I think needs to happen is platforms need to be properly defined in the law. So if you're not behaving like a platform, if you're not behaving like a neutral platform, you should lose the protection of Section 230. And just to recap briefly, Section 230 is what social media platforms rely on to say, well, I'm not liable, or I'm not legally liable for the posts of my Twitter, of my users. I'm not legally liable for, YouTube isn't legally liable for YouTube videos. Twitter's not liable for the posts of Twitter users. You can't be sued for death. If someone defames you on Twitter, you can't sue Twitter. You can sue the Twitter user, but not Twitter itself. And that's obviously essential to their business model, because they would be able to post all of this content if they were liable for it all. So it's a very critical law for them. So it makes sense, I think, to attach some strings to that law and say, look, if you're not actually behaving like a neutral platform, if you're behaving more like a publisher, deciding what people see, editing content, suppressing content, promoting other content, then much like publishers, you should be liable for defamation. And I think once you do that, the tech giants it'll become far less profitable for the tech giants to censor. There'll be a huge financial cost attached to that. In fact, it's threat to their entire business model, because if they're no longer a platform, they're suddenly liable, their business model falls apart. So the question is, what are we going to say the definition of a platform is? And I think the solution is very, very simple. A platform is a platform if it doesn't filter constitutionally protected content on behalf of its users. So they can still create filters, much like Google has an obscenity filter that you can turn on, off or on. The safe search button on Google, you can see it's the top right-hand corner of any Google page. You turn safe search on or off, and that filters obscene search results. They can give similar buttons for every other filter they've created on legal speech, whether it's hate speech or fake news or conspiracy theories. But they've chosen not to, because clearly they value control over political information, control over their news, more than they value consumer choice. So I think part of the Section 230 report has to be, you're not going to filter on behalf of your users. You can only give them the option to filter their own feeds, their own search results, if they want. I think that has to be the test.
Okay, I think that's I think that is pretty reasonable. I think that sidesteps a lot of the worries that people have pointed out. I mean, there is a concern. I think it's legit that some of the libertarians point out that if you make the regulation dependent on some government bureau to enforce, these things tend up not to turn out very well for Republicans and conservatives. Therefore, I think there's some fairness there. But what you're proposing isn't so much something that you have to have a big department step in and enforce all the time, kind of like the FCC, but something that would just be a basic rule that they're expected to follow. So I guess I could see how that would work.
Enforcement is an interesting thing. I think the ideal way to enforce this kind of thing is through the courts, not through bureaucracy. Because as you say, you know, bureaucracy can enforce the wrong acts. But if you leave it up to the courts, then you'll have a situation where, you know, there'll be defamation cases against these tech giants, and the court will decide whether they're platforms or publishers. I think that's the test. And if a court says, okay, well, you're filtering content, so you're a publisher now, and they lose a case, they'll probably I imagine that act very quickly to change their technology, to change their filtering, to make sure they don't lose future cases. So that's the way you answer the question against them.
No, I agree. Thank you very much for writing this book. Thank you for your awesome report. Even before the podcast, I've been reading your stuff. The very first episode of the podcast, we talked about the Alex Jones being deleted off Twitter. I hope this issue gets better. I worry, too, about the future of our democracy if this stuff doesn't get nipped in the bud. But let's hope it does. I mean, who knows? Who knows what will be in our future, and hopefully it'll be lots of positive stuff instead of what the rest of 2020 has been. Well, thank you so much, Alan. This is a real treat. Thank you for all you do. If you guys want to follow Alan Bukhari on Twitter, he is at Libertarian Blue. Again, at Libertarian Blue. And of course, you can find him at Breitbart. Just look up author/Alan Bukhari, and there he is. Well, you have a wonderful day, sir. Thank you for the book. I look forward to your further project.
Thank you, Peter. Great to be on.
Hello, folks, and we are back. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Alan Bukhari. For our last segment, I want to go into what you can expect for the presidential election that comes out last week. What do I think the chances are of a Trump or Biden victory, and what is the evidence of it, and why I think that? Plus, we're going to talk a little bit here about the presidential debate and a tiny bit about the ACB. So, I have been pretty honest with you guys in my analysis of who I think is going to win this election based on where the polls are, what I'm hearing for experts, and what are the reactions from inside the campaigns. You can learn a lot about internal polling based on how the campaigns conduct themselves and what they try to tell their supporters to expect or not. Just last week, after the debate, the Biden campaign said privately to its people that do not think that they have the win in the bag, that they needed to try to remain competitive and not just assume that they were going to win all these key states. And there is interesting polling from some alternative polling groups and some mainstream ones that suggests that Trump is much more competitive in many of these states than it says he is. Places like Rasmussen Reports and the Trafalgar Group. Plus, when you look at key groups, for example, black voters, you see some interesting things happening that suggest that there might be more Trump supporters than what the pollsters are bringing up. Even people like Megyn Kelly, a major reporter, is saying that we are overestimating the Biden support in the polls. And it is a lot to ask to think that Joe Biden would be 10 or 15% ahead in the polls in the current political environment. It's just very difficult to believe that there could be that much swing for the Democratic side. That is a lot to ask. That would be a landslide kind of election. And perhaps that is what will happen in a week from now. But based on everything I'm seeing, based on the contention in the air, based on the polls and what I'm reading, I just don't think that's the case. And interestingly enough, not all the hidden data, the hard-to-find data, is in Trump's favor. Some of it is actually in Biden's. In Texas, it looks like Trump and Biden could be in a neck-and-neck race with Biden 1 point ahead. For the battleground states right now, it is looking like Minnesota, Michigan, and possibly Nevada are strongly in the Biden camp, with Ohio and Georgia and Florida leaning towards competitive. In the point of Ohio, that actually is in Trump's favor by 0.6, according to Real Clear Politics. I would add that I think that Trump has a possible edge in Arizona as well. That one seems to be just on the line. According to the polls that I have, even from Real Clear Politics, a state like Michigan or Minnesota, those are so clearly out of the way for a Trump win. It's almost surprising. Now, one thing you may be see swimming around on Facebook and in conservative media is this idea that the error that was in the polls back in 2016 is similar to the error we're seeing now. And there is some truth here. The numbers that we have for Clinton and the numbers we have for Biden by edge are extremely similar. Here's an example. In 2016, Hillary Clinton held about an average of a 3.5 lead in the following battleground states: North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Arizona, and Wisconsin, according to polls. Well, as you may remember, those are the battleground states Trump won. Well, this time, Biden currently holds a 4-point lead on the average for these states. And this isn't just a conservative talking point. If you go to Real Clear Politics, they do the math for this, and they show you top battlegrounds 2020 versus 2016. And you look at the numbers put on a graph, and it's extremely striking, the prediction in the 2016 models and the prediction being made on the 2020 models. And the bias towards who is counted to determine these polls is extremely similar as well. 2016 modeling was based on a new way of looking at models because they no longer could get landlines, so it was based on who they connect for mobile and internet. And we are still largely using that model of contacting people. Also, the bias in these models does veer for Democrats. They have, you know, there'll be a 5 or 6 swing towards the Democrats and the people they contact for these polls, but that's put on the assumption that more Democrats will show up to vote on Election Day, which could be true. Remember, there are more Democrats, there are more left-leaning voters in the United States than there are on the right. So, but you do have to admit that there is a flaw in that modeling, right? And if the flaws in the model led them to be making the wrong predictions back in 2016, you would have to ask, perhaps they're making that flaw again in 2020. And I talked about this last week, but groups like the Trafalgar Group, led by pollster Robert Cahill, his group, they're based on the models that they used in 2016, and they predicted it correctly for Trump. They believe that Trump will be able to narrowly beat Biden in a 270 Electoral College vote win. Trafalgar Group's official prediction for this election is that the Trump campaign will be able to hold Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, and Georgia, which would be just enough to beat the Biden campaign. And there are interesting numbers that would show that there is some more support for Donald Trump this week than there was last week. For example, with the black vote, it has now come back that it's at 46% right now of support for POTUS. 46% of the African-American community is supporting Donald Trump right now. What percentage of that will be turned into votes for Donald Trump? If Donald Trump is even able to hold on to a quarter of the black votes, traditionally, that would mean that Donald Trump wins this re-election. And I wouldn't count that out as being not a possibility. Remember, as we talked about last month, black Americans are extremely concerned about the public safety issue. 67% of black Americans are concerned about public safety where they live, and they are concerned about a shortage of police officers and the reduced public safety in the community where they live. And in the culture, we are seeing advantages for Trump. 50 Cent, a big figure in the popular media, as we already know. Kanye's there as well, who've come out in support of the president. I love 50 Cent when he said, I'm supporting President Donald Trump because I don't want to be 20 Cent. And which I just think that's a fabulous line. I love it. Trump has seen some major gains, in particular with young black male voters. Trump's support among young black voters from age 18 to 44 increased from 10% in 2016 to about 21% right now, according to UCLA NationScape's polling. Charlemagne the God, the Breakfast Club podcast host, radio guy, rapper, he's a really cool figure. Charlemagne the God was asked on CNN, what's going on? Why is it to seem that young black men are attracted to the Trump campaign? And Charlemagne answered, I'm reading from the CNN transcript, I don't like that narrative, Charlemagne told Don Lemon. You know, because if Trump wins, they're able to turn this into a black men are the reason why Trump is in office. But
I think, you know, to even answer your question more deeply, I think, you know, when it comes to those black people you see who may be, you know, showing support for Trump, I just think, you know, it's because Trump is actually talking to young black male voters. He's directing ads towards them. They are a group that, you know, never get courted. I mean, black people don't get courted either as a whole, but that old Democratic regime speaks to old black men, and they think everyone else in the black community, the black family, is just supposed to fall in line. They know black women are going to show up regardless, and, you know, they, like I said, they speak to older black men, and they think the rest of us all speak the same language. So Trump is targeting young black males, and promo and marketing, it works.
And it isn't just happening in the African-American community. President Trump, as we see in Florida, has gained big support from Latinos, at least for your typical Republican. According to, again, to the UCLA NationScape polling, they have found that President Trump is attracting sometimes 35% of Hispanic voters under 45, compared to 22% who supported him in 2016. And should we be surprised if he has growing support from the Latino and African-American community? He made it a point to feature at the RNC many top professional speakers who are black, who are Latino, who come from those communities, who are also Republican. President Trump has made a top feature on justice and crime reform. This is, you know, some of that has got to have some effect. And not dissimilar to the hidden Trump voter. We are assuming when people say hidden Trump voter, they mean white person. Your typical white Republican that's scared to say they are. It could also, though, mean a Hispanic person, an African-American, who are afraid to say that they're supporting Trump because of all the cultural pressures that are on them against them for saying something like that. Now, we will go into the debate and how it impacts the race, but before we do, one of the things you're hearing right now is that there are about 60 million people that have come out to vote already. And this is something new we haven't seen before. We've seen absentee voting, but we've never seen this many people show up, this high a percentage of the electorate show up to vote before Election Day. But if you look at the stats from the exit polls, it looks that it's about 55-56% are Democrats and about 21% are Republicans. And that's hard to believe. But if it is true, that means that the people who are going to turn out on Election Day could be disproportionately Republican and Trump supporters. So there are things here in the numbers with the context, if you look at this, that President Trump's campaign are running a heck of a lot stronger than they were at the beginning of the month and even last week. They have made up a lot of the problems they were having. They're, now that this thing is getting closer, more people are being turned to choose one direction or another. And I think that debate cemented a lot of never-Trumpers and sometimes Trumpers to go the Trump campaign's way. And the last two factors are the debate and the Hunter Biden story, which our first segment today was based on, the Hunter Biden story, and how those play into the polls and where they're at. So if you didn't see the debate, I recommend you look it up, go watch it. It's a great hour and a half. It's a so much better debate than that first one was. This one was energetic and interesting, and the moderator did a decent job. Not perfect. She came and she interjected sometimes for Biden, but overall it was a pretty solid debate. But this debate made a big difference for the Trump campaign and has been a big hurt on the Biden campaign for several reasons. The first reason that the debate has been a plus for Trump and a hurt for Biden is because Biden came out on several issues and said things that are perfectly honest and are what their party and their campaign is about, but are incredibly detrimental. And this is one of the negatives. When you have the media carry your water all the time, sometimes when they spill a drop, when they miss some, it looks really, really bad. The biggest example that comes to mind is this part in the debate where Biden basically comes out against fracking and oil in general, and this is just a disastrous thing to say on national television.
pollutions, that the pollutants coming out of those fence line communities.
Okay, I have one final
question.
Would
he close down the oil industry?
It falls.
Would you close down the oil industry?
By the way, I would transition from the oil industry, yes.
Oh, I would transition.
It is a big statement.
That's a
because
big statement.
I would stop.
Why would you do that?
Because the oil industry pollutes.
That part where the moderator says, why would you say that? I think a lot of Dems, when he said that, would be like, ah, no, ah. And it really is bad, okay? The energy boom we've had over the last decade is one of the positive stories of America. It saved our economy from the recession more so than about any other economic factor. In swing states like Michigan and Pennsylvania, fracking is a huge boon to those economies. Nationwide, in the Midwest, it's helpful. People do not have the same view of it as they do on the East and West Coast. That issue, going on the side of saying I'm against fracking, does not help you in any of the battleground states. All the people that hate oil are in blue states, and they're already solid in Biden's camp. So this was a disastrous moment. The Pennsylvania newspapers went wild on this. This has been really bad. The Nation, after this came out, their headline was Earth to Biden, Stop Talking About Fracking. So that moment was just a disastrous, disastrous thing to say, and it's going to cost him dearly. Another moment that was a painful one for the Biden campaign is Biden comes out in support of Obamacare, which it's not a very popular measure, but it's not super detrimental. But then he says this statement.
There to negotiate drug prices with the insurance companies. Thirdly, the idea that I want to eliminate private insurance. The reason why I had such a fight with 20 candidates for the nomination was I support private insurance. That's why I didn't. Not one single person with private insurance would lose their insurance under my plan, nor did they under Obamacare. They did not lose their insurance unless they chose they wanted to go to something else.
That statement, the Obamacare, no one lost their health insurance under Obamacare, is so factually untrue. Even PolitiFact, PolitiFrickin'Fact, said it was their lie of the year, okay? Back in 2011. It was their lie of the year. The famous Obama line.
We will keep this promise to the American people. If you like your doctor, you will be able to keep your doctor. Period. If you like your health care plan, you'll be able to keep your health care plan. Period.
Now, you have to understand how much I detest that moment because I lost my health care plan and I didn't get to keep my doctor. And a good portion of Americans had the same experience. We know when it was still being fact-checked that at least 5 million Americans lost their insurance that same year after the ACA. But even when you go to places like the Commonwealth Fund and they look at the numbers and health insurance rates are a little worse off than they were in 2010, even by the nicest of numbers. Okay, according to them, today about 45% of U.S. adults aged 19 to 64 are inadequately insured. A little more than back in 2010. And I will tell you, the way those numbers are played, the damage it did to people is much worse than ever really got out. Okay, because it raised the price of insurance for everyone, it raised the deductible, and it made the healthcare effectively worse. Everything just became more expensive, and less people could get into the system. And as one of these disabled Americans who has actually tried to work in the system, get disability, do everything right, it's just about impossible. It's a mess. And so when Biden has this moment, he says no one lost their health insurance under the ACA. That just cannot play well. If anyone that had lost their insurance during this time, he hears Biden say that. I mean, come on. Come on, man. Come on. That is just not going to play well. The last moment that really hurt the Bidens, and this has a little less to do with actual what Biden did during the debate and more so how social media reacted, was the Hunter Biden moment. Now, let me be honest. I put out on social media, and I tried to say that if Trump is going to talk about this in the debate, he has to say it in a way so the normies understand. He has to be clear. Trump has a problem of talking as if everyone he's talking to already knows the story he's talking about. He assumes they know, they listen in like he does. They watch the Fox News, they listen to talk radio. That's how he speaks. Now, it's kind of fun, and if you listen to those things, watch those things, you can understand what he's talking about. But with a media that's extremely antagonistic and will purposely take his words out of context, he has to be super clear. And I'll be honest, I did not think Trump was as clear as he could be. However, all in all, the Hunter Biden and how Biden handles it in the debate did not play very well, and there are polls now showing that it's hurting him.
Told me that.
Did your account
Nobody
tell
you,
you
that. Excuse
them?
Me. And it wasn't written whenever they write this. They keep talking about $750, which I think is a filing fee. But let me just tell you, I prepaid millions and millions of dollars in taxes, number one. Number two, I don't make money from China. You do. I don't make money from Ukraine. You do. I don't make money from Russia. You made $3.5 million, Joe, and your son gave you. They even have a statement that we have to give 10% to the big man. You're the big man, I think. I don't know. Maybe you're not. But you're the big man, I think. Your son said we have to give 10% to the big man. Joe, what's that all about? It's terrible.
All right, gentlemen, I want to ask you both some questions.
And you do live very well. You have houses all over the place. You live very well.
All right, gentlemen, let me just ask some questions about all of this broadly. Vice President Biden, there have been questions about the work your son has done in China and for a Ukrainian energy company when you were vice president. In retrospect, was anything about those relationships inappropriate or unethical?
Nothing was unethical. Here's what the deal. With regard to Ukraine, we had this whole question about whether or not, because he was on the board, I later learned, of a Burisma, a company, that somehow I had done something wrong. Yet every single solitary person, when he was going through his impeachment, testifying under oath who worked for him, said, I did my job impeccably. I carried out U.S. policy. Not one single solitary thing was out of line. Not a single thing, number one. Number two, the guy who got in trouble in Ukraine was this guy trying to bribe the Ukrainian government to say something negative about me, which they would not do and did not do because it never, ever, ever happened. My son has not made money in terms of this thing about, what are you talking about, China. I have not had, the only guy made money from China is this guy. He's the only one. Nobody else has made money from China.
Now, that moment went poorly for Biden because it raised the issue, because the news media had not touched it and refused to touch it. It was news to the people who heard it. And I thought that because the way the social media masters are playing and the press refusing to talk about it, and everyone saying this is misinformation from the Russians, which is just crazy. Those Ruskies are so busy. They get free rent in all those journalists' minds. Well, I was wrong, because according to data from Google, it shows that number one online story in the U.S. about the debate was about the Biden corruption. Okay, first from Axios. Coverage of business dealings by Joe Biden's son and pre-debate allegations of one of his former business associates, Tony Bobulinski, garnered more than twice as much online activity, including likes, comments, and shares, as the runner-up. The second place topic was the former vice president's comments on oil and fracking. Social media interactions on stories about Hunter and Bobulinski reportedly stood at 1.3 million searches, far more than the discussions over the second place topic. Well, according to a new poll that came out today by Rasmussen Reports, this is being reported by the New York Post, a survey of 1,000 likely voters found 54% of them believe it's likely Biden was consulted about and perhaps profited from Hunter Biden's overseas business deals. 44% of those consider it very likely. 38 said it was unlikely Biden was involved in his son's affairs. 21 who said it was not at all likely. So it seems between the debate, Trump bringing it up, and the way that the social media giants have tried to cover up the story, that it's actually caused what's referred to as a Streisand effect. Jonah Goldberg coined the term when Barbara Streisand tried to make it impossible for people to see her property on Google. This is what's happening. It's a Streisand effect moment. The story is too big. Despite all the hard efforts of the Silicon Giants, they still can't kill off the interest in it completely. So this debate overall had some really strong moments that really hurt Joe Biden. And the positive moments for Joe Biden in the debate were on issues that the people are largely already with him. Joe Biden did great handling the coronavirus story. Joe Biden was pretty strong in trying to allegate that Trump was on the side of the Russians. But the people who believe in that stuff and are persuaded by that stuff were already in the Biden camp. So there wasn't a lot that Biden could make gains to. He could only protect the gains he had. And Joe Biden at the debate, Joe Biden since the debate, has made gaffes after gaffes after gaffes after gaffes that make him seem like he's not totally with it. I wouldn't go so far as saying he's senile, but you have a hard time believing he's fit to be president when it's a job that requires a tremendous amount of attention, energy, and health. Just yesterday, Biden made this huge gaffe where he said he was running against someone named George. Yeah, I know. And now, the media has tried to say he was talking about George Lopez, but it makes very little sense.
Because who I'm running against, this is the most consequential election in a long, long, long time. And the character of the country, in my view, is literally on the ballot. What kind of country we're going to be. Four more years of George, is going to find ourselves in a position where if Trump gets elected, we're going to be in a different world. And so
he is making serious gaffes like this daily basis, and the media covers for all of them, but they have got to be having a little bit of impact. I mean, there's this moment where this is just going to fuel all the conspiracy thinkers here.
Secondly, we're in a situation where we have put together, and you guys did it for our administration, the President Obama's administration before this. We have put together, I think, the most extensive and inclusive voter fraud organization in the history of American politics.
Yikes. I mean, that is really bad. And I don't even want to get to the issue of voter electoral fraud. I think we've talked to that issue to death. But these are just bad moments, okay? And I can't imagine when we're getting closer and closer to Election Day that all these gaffes are going to slip under the radar of voters who are Googling and are being on social media and trying to decide who they're going to vote for. I think the persuadables still, by large, haven't voted yet. And I think looking at the polls, I think considering the debate points, considering the issue of Hunter Biden, considering the support of African-American and Latinos, considering the weird way the Biden campaign is acting, there are so many people who are talking about internal polling, insider polling, people, reporters and stuff that know people that work in these campaigns that said that the Biden people do not think this is one and done. They are not giving the signal they think this is going to be a landslide. They think it's going to be tight. And so I am strongly persuaded to give Trump a fighting chance. So here is my final prediction. I will give Trump a 45% chance of winning on November the 3rd. Okay? I'm going to give him a 45, maybe a 50, but at least a 45% chance of winning re-election. I think the Republican Senate is a lot less likely. I will give it a 40% of holding on to the Republican Senate. But this is a much stronger and tighter race than it was just a week ago. And that largely has to do with the Hunter Biden story, the debate, and just, you know, people just paying attention. Things always tighten usually right before the election. I don't know if there are any more October surprises to be had. We've had so many. We've now done four of these October surprise episodes because every week is so crazy. There's so much happening in this election. Every week there's new stuff, and it has just been a wild, wild ride if you pay attention to politics in the United States. And of course, we have ACB, and ACB is a big win for Republicans. It's a big win for Trump. And for those who are on the sidelines, this is going to help. It could also energize the Democrats. AOC is now leading the charge with many Democrats in the House, especially, who are saying that we have to go with judicial reform, we have to go with court packing, we have to do this now. Nancy Pelosi said that the Republicans stole the seat. The tensions right now are fairly high in an already very intense partisan political environment. And it's in my view that even if Trump loses next week, if the Republicans lose the Senate, and that I'm much more worried about that than I am about losing the presidency, to be honest. You got ACB on the court. You have reshaped the federal judiciary for 10, 20 years. There are big things happening, and there are positives to be counted. We will have an episode this Saturday, come rain or shine, because I just want to get in through the last things right before we go through the voting day. But here are the things you need to know, okay? Tuesday is going to be wild. Because of the early ballots, because the Supreme Court has ruled in places like Pennsylvania that ballots can be counted up, mail-in ballots can be counted 3 days after the election, and they do not have to be clearly postmarked that they were put in before that. And it is, according to the Supremes, again, you cannot use signature validation. You cannot check the signatures against each other. All of which is going to put a wild amount of mistrust into this election for whoever wins or loses. I mean, the amount of people that are going to believe this election is legitimate is going to be, it's going to be a new level we've never seen before. It's going to be 2000, the Florida-Chad fight, like on steroids, like 1,000. It's just going to be an insane, insane fight. And we are not going to know who won this thing unless it is a landslide for weeks, possibly months, possibly even into January. Definitely probably into December. And that is going to be one heck of a shock to the country. And that is really going to shake us up. And it's going to be messy. It's going to be messy. So we are going to end it here. I am so happy ACB is in. I am very worried about big tech and journalism choosing to try to take the power away from the people and hold it for themselves and the elite. It makes me very concerned about the future of the Republic and the future of conservative and libertarian and freedom movements. Those are issues that really worry me that go way, way beyond the election. I think the election is a lot better for Trump than it was, a lot better for Republicans than it was, but it'll still be a hard fight, whatever the result. Well, guys, it's been fun. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Hope you enjoy the interview. Until next time, ladies and gents, good night, America.
Thank you for listening. The Happy Warrior Podcast, hosted by Peter Von Pischke, produced by Robert Mayling, a production of the Sioux Empire Podcast Network. Learn more at happy-warrior.net.
A production of the SiouxEmpire.com.